Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Pakistan, Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan is revered as the father of the country's nuclear bomb. In Washington, he is described as the Johnny Appleseed of the nuclear arms race. Last month, A.Q. Khan confessed to fueling a stunning international black market in nuclear weapons technology. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf expressed dismay and promptly pardoned the good doctor. Publicly, the White House has accepted that pardon, but is the story over? Tonight on Point, the unresolved threat of the nuclear weapons bazaar born in Pakistan. After nearly two decades of secret nuclear proliferation, do you trust that the A-bomb black market is really being shut down? And what's the deal that has turned down the heat on Pakistan? Is it worth it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Las Vegas, Nevada, is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest article, The Deal, appears in this week's New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome, Seymour Hersh.
Yes, and make it clear, I don't live here. I'm just trans.
But he's in Las Vegas right now. It's great to have you with us. We've been talking about this just last week. We were looking at what has been going on with U.S. preparations for spring offensive on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And, of course, all the talk of A.Q. Khan is swirling about that. You've taken a big dive into it this week in the New Yorker, Cy Hersh. There's a lot to jump into here. You've got Robert Gillespie, former U.N.'s weapons inspector, now dean at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, saying we haven't been this vulnerable since the British burned Washington in 1814. What's he talking about?
It's Gallucci, but Gallucci, Bob Gallucci.
Yes.
He was also an arms controller for the U.N. and also as a consultant on proliferation for the American intelligence community right now. Basically what it is that the real fear is because of sort of, in a way, because of what A.Q. Khan has done, and that is by two decades of merchandising this stuff. In the last year or so, we've discovered that these guys have really gone wholesale in a lot of countries that have nothing to do with the bomb, like Malaysia. No interest in making a nuclear weapon itself is suddenly selling and manufacturing with the greatest of specificity, because they have they're such good high-tech people there, manufacturing centrifuge parts and other nuclear parts, very sensitive parts, and selling them to the best buyer. So we're really looking at anybody with cash. We're looking at what they call non-state proliferation. We're looking at, for the first time, the worry is that, yes, we can deal with a Libya and a Gaddafi. We can deal with an Iran. We can deal with North Korea. We have there's a lot of problems, a lot of tensions, but they're states and they're controlled. Mm. We're now worried about terrorist groups, non-state groups, being able, with enough money, to get whatever they need on the market. And that's what they found in Libya with Gaddafi. They found incredible stuff, the highest tech stuff. Gaddafi couldn't make a bomb. You know, they have trouble getting their phones going. They weren't in any way potentially using the material. They just had it. They bought it because they could.
And what they had, as you describe it, Cy Hersh, is blueprints for a bomb, a sweet little bomb, one of the intelligence contacts you spoke to described it as, saying it's too big and heavy for a Scud, but it'll go into a family car. It's a terrorist's dream. And it came from?
Probably a Chinese model. The original, what they call the Chick-4, it's probably a bomb the Chinese tested in the 60s. China and Pakistan were doing a lot of work together way back in the 80s. And even into the 90s, very close relationship. I don't know where that relationship stands now. It's probably cooled in terms of nuclear transfer because Pakistan is independent now. Pakistan is a proliferator, has 40 or 50 bombs. But back in those days, China clearly passed along plans on how to build a bomb. And A.Q. Khan, we believe, or his minions, sold probably through cutouts, through this great international black market that exists, sold the plans. And the inspector, the person I talked to, actually was somebody who was an official of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, in Vienna, the international group that monitors the non-proliferation treaty for the world. And this guy, they have gone there for two or three occasions into Libya to look at what Gaddafi has. And two stunning findings. One was, as you said, they had plans that you could, a group of technicians, you didn't have to be nuclear scientists, a group of technicians could put together a reasonably good weapon based on the 300 pages of plans. And the second thing they discovered is all of these wonderful sensitive devices, centrifuge parts. Centrifuges are pieces of machinery that are used to enrich uranium to weapons grade level. So that you can fire off a bomb.
Yep.
All of the stuff they had purchased from Malaysia, they found it unopened in boxes. And clearly, one interesting thought is that Gaddafi, the head of Muammar Gaddafi, the head of Libya, who's been desperately trying to get into the good graces of the United States and Great Britain, the West, it seems clear that a lot of the stuff that happened is because of Gaddafi. Gaddafi bought the stuff from Malaysia. He came to us. He turned over what he knew. He helped us get a fix on what's going on, for which he did get brownie points. And the net result is that it seems clear, and this is what Bob Gallucci is talking about, if you have enough cash, you can get a bomb. And if you're a terror group with enough cash, you can get a bomb. And every terror group isn't as obvious and as Al-Qaeda. As Osama bin Laden out there giving jihads, presumably there are groups there who are not good at their heart, who are quietly and competently capable of going about putting together the parts and doing something with it.
And Libya's centrifuge ended up under the scrutiny of the international community, but you quote intelligence people saying machinery like that could just as well end up in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan. The thin wash put over this, Sehersh, by Washington last month, was that A.Q. Khan had confessed and he'd been pardoned and kind of that's that. But you say, you're just back from Pakistan, and you say it's all make-believe.
Well, the big critical problem with first of all, A.Q. Khan is just of a piece. First of all, you have to understand the notion that A.Q. Khan's responsible as the state, the president of Pakistan, Musharraf, who we have to remember was a army general who seized power in a coup and then has since revised the constitution to allow himself to stay in office at least through 2007 or probably forever. We're not talking about some Democrat here, but nonetheless, he's our guy. And Musharraf's, the public, it's sort of like a kabuki dance that you watched. They have a big public show. A.Q. Khan comes in, is wrapped on his knuckles by Musharraf on television. Mm-hmm. In a show trial that reminded me of what I read about Beria and Stalin in the old Russian days. And then the next day he's pardoned, which means this. His pardon means, and this I discovered after leaving Pakistan and going around the world and talking to people in the business, in the proliferation business, not only in Vienna, but in some capitals. In every capital and in Vienna, I found this, a great deal of anger at the United States for accepting this dance that was shown, this showcase, this make-believe performance, as I put it.
And why exactly the anger? We can imagine, but why precisely?
Because they can't get their hands on A.Q. Khan. What the IAEA and what various countries, Israel is one, obviously, they want a chance to have their people go in and debrief A.Q. Khan. We think there's hundreds, literally hundreds of companies that are involved in for money selling dual-use equipment that has a perfectly good technical use but also could be used to make a weapon. And one of the things we know about A.Q. Khan, he's been around for more than two decades. Our community's been tracking him. Some of the companies now selling junk that we saw ending up in Libya and Iran, this latest go-around of scandal, some of those companies are now being run by the sons of people we first met in the late 70s and 80s when they were responsible for helping Pakistan get the bomb.
It's really incredible. You described second-generation proliferators already, and in all that time, a stop not put to it. As you point out, Sehersh, in Pakistan, A.Q. Khan is still a hero. The public opinion there is he's been made a scapegoat. You've got plenty of people saying, look, yes, he was deep in this, but this was fundamentally state policy of Pakistan, and is it clear that it's no longer state policy?
Well, it's clear that Musharraf is telling us it is no longer state policy. And just as Musharraf tells us he's going to do something to crack down on the madrasas, the religious schools in Pakistan, which he has not done, just as he's promising to do things in Kashmir and do things to smooth over relationships with India, there's a lot of words there, but the actions are just not there. He's got tremendous pressures from inside. He's sitting on a volcano, and we haven't got to the core. The reason, obviously, as I'm writing in this piece, that the United States, the Bush administration, is so happily accepts there's gambling on the premises, disclosures in Pakistan. Oh my God!
Shocked.
There's been proliferation. We accept it because my friends in the American intelligence community and the special forces community tell me that there's a very explicit quid pro quo here. Musharraf, the last thing Musharraf wants to do is to let us operate militarily against bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the Taliban from Pakistan. Because many people in the Pakistan military, particularly the intelligence service of Pakistan, supported the Taliban, supported bin Laden.
And bin Laden, who's now believed to be in northwest Pakistan, lots of U.S. troops right across the border in Afghanistan, they want to get in there.
And what we want to do, in the past, there was a famous example a few years ago in a place called Tora Bora, where we made this sort of disastrous offensive to try and drive the al-Qaeda out and attack them and get them, including bin Laden, so we thought. And instead what they did is there's a mountain range called the Hindu Kush Mountains, very tough mountain range. They simply went over the mountains or through the mountains through passes into Pakistan. What we want to do this time, and you have to do think specifically about election year, this time we've won permission from Musharraf to bring American troops into Pakistan. They're not there yet. We're already beginning. There are some special forces people that have been there for a long time operating in secret along the border. But I'm talking about thousands of troops to come, some of them being sent from Iraq, no less, are now being told that their next stop is going to be in Pakistan in secret bases. I write that the supply, the buildup for the logistical buildup of helicopters and equipment has already begun in Pakistan. Our planes are flying in at night into bases controlled by the American Air Force inside Pakistan and unloading equipment. And eventually, 2,000 to 5,000 more troops will show up when the snow begins to melt off the passes next month in April. And we will start a major offensive on the Afghan side. American troops will then move into the mountains where we think Musharraf might be and block any—
Where bin Laden escape. Might be, right?
I beg your pardon. Where bin Laden might be.
Mm-hmm.
And block it. And so, ergo, we get bin Laden and Bush gets, rides the white horse for a little while.
And a very important little while up to a presidential election. And this, Sahersh, you describe as the deal, which may even include access of U.S. troops onto Pakistani soil. But here's the question that raises in my mind. Short term, that may be great. Osama bin Laden gets captured, looks good for George Bush. But long term, the subhead of the headline on your article is, "Why is Washington going easy on Pakistan's nuclear black marketeers?" Long term, can it be a good deal for the United States or anybody else to trade off cracking down on underground nuclear weapons technology marketeering to capture one man in the mountains of Pakistan?
No, of course not. I mean, ultimately, what happens is it's a proliferation nightmare. Ultimately, in the long run, we've left the trapdoor open in a way. We're not going to be able to get the access to the kind of information, the names. We need AQ Khan's Rolodex. We need Pakistan's Rolodex. We need to know with whom they've been in touch around the world in the last 2 dozen years, the last 20 years or so.
And that's what we're not getting, because the pardon's there, and as you describe it, the fix is in.
Well, and I'll tell you another way it could bounce back. It also, once, the large quantities of American troops are not there yet. They've been put on notice. They'll be coming later. But once they do get here, I don't think they can mask it. Everybody realizes, no matter how covert we try to be about it, it'll be known. And the Pakistani military, which doesn't like Musharraf, he's not a very popular figure, will go absolutely nutty with the idea of American soldiers doing offensive operations against Pakistan's former allies, the Taliban, in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda. They're sort of all mingled together there. And it could also destabilize Musharraf enormously. So it's a short-run win for President Bush, presuming we get bin Laden if we do. In the long run, it could have consequences for this ally, whether you like him or don't like him. He's somebody who's done what we wanted.
Mm.
And also terrible consequences in the farther long run for all of us in terms of proliferation. We need to know what AQ Khan knows, and we're not going to get it.
Sihir, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the unresolved threat of the nuclear weapons bazaar born in Pakistan. My guest is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New Yorker. You can join the conversation. If Pakistan has been the global supplier of black market nukes for 20 years, why are we in Iraq? And if AQ Khan is the world's number one nuclear weapons distributor, why isn't he in Guantanamo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unresolved threat of the nuclear weapons bazaar born in Pakistan. My guest tonight is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New Yorker. His article this week in The New Yorker is The Deal, Why is Washington Going Easy on Pakistan's Nuclear Black Marketers? You can join our conversation tonight. If going easy on Pakistan's nuclear bazaar is the trade-off for a clear shot at Osama bin Laden, is that a good deal? And after two decades of secret commerce in rogue nukes, are you confident that everything's suddenly A-OK now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation from Belmont, Massachusetts, Jim Walsh. He's executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome, Jim Walsh.
Hey, Tom, and hi, Cy. How are you guys doing?
Hello, Jim.
We're great. Thanks for joining us. Jim Walsh, you've been listening. You've heard and probably read what Cy Hersh is describing in this piece. How active is an ongoing underground bazaar in nuclear weapons technology?
Well, I can tell you this, that whatever level it is right now, it's higher than any of us, myself and others, really anticipated or ever expected. And I loved your questions as you went to break. You asked the question, well, if Iraq was a proliferation threat and then Pakistan's a proliferation threat, which is the greater threat? Which should have we spent more time on? And I think what Cy Hersh's article does is it really lays out why this is the biggest story in non-proliferation as far as I can remember. It's certainly bigger than Iraq. Iraq doesn't hold a candle. Even if Saddam had some chemical weapons, this would hold. It would be nothing compared to what's happened in Pakistan, and arguably perhaps even more important than the Indian and Pakistani tests in 98, which obviously were unwelcome. But this is a huge, huge story. And the other part of it that is certainly that Cy talks about in his article is that it's not just the last year, the last 2 years that this has happened, but really it's been a joke in among my colleagues for decades that if you want to track proliferation, you should get the travel itinerary of AQ Khan. And that really raises the question, how long have we known about this? And why we haven't done something sooner.
What about now? I mean, Cy Hersh raises this incredible image here, this picture of the United States pouring troops into the godforsaken mountains in northwest Pakistan to find this 1 6-foot-5 very famous guy who's got a lot of videotapes out of himself, while meanwhile there's an underground market in nuclear weapons technology that could be flowing anywhere. Sweet little bombs that could fit in a family sedan, he's quoting people saying. Is it that active? And if it is, why has no terrorist organization used one of those sweet little bombs?
Well, I think that you've put your finger on something important here, and that is that there's both bad news and good news in this story. And the bad news is that this has been functioning for a long time and is really a nightmare, where you have someone who's an entrepreneur out there and selling nuclear technology. In my field, the view is always, well, this stuff is demand-driven. A country wants a nuclear weapon for a security reason or prestige or bureaucratic politics, so they go out and they seek it. Here we have a completely different story. It's like tobacco or drug pushers. It's folks who are where it's supply driven, where the folks are out selling it. So people who might not even have thought about taking on a nuclear weapons program are suddenly presented an opportunity and they say, hey, I'll do that. So this is a huge story, but there is some good news here. And the good news is, despite the 20-year plus activity of AQ Khan and others, that we haven't had more proliferation, that in many of these cases, countries have chosen not to accept those sales, or in the case of Libya, have chosen to accept them but were too inept to act on what they got, and then eventually, for strategic reasons, decided to go in another direction. So there is some good news here, and the good news is it could have been a heck of a lot worse, because this thing has been going on for a while. And you and Cy have argued, well, we're turning our head now because of a deal that might have been made vis-a-vis bin Laden. But if you step back, this looking away, this turning away of what was happening has probably gone on for some time. And during the Cold War, it's because we wanted Pakistan's help to slip people into Afghanistan to cause trouble for the Soviets. And now it's we want his help with terrorism. But I think it's been going on for a while.
Cy Hirsch, what's the evidence that this was indeed state policy and not just the back pocket business of AQ Khan?
Well, it's not as if you have a motion picture camera about a state policy. But I'll quote you with somebody who's been in the business, somebody who was very much involved in Pakistan in the 80s. In one of our intelligence agencies, and still involved at a sort of more sophisticated level now. And he said, look, suppose that Edward Teller had suddenly decided to spread nuclear technology and equipment around the world. Do you really think he could have done so without the government knowing? How do you get missiles from North Korea to Pakistan? Do you think AQ Khan shipped all of the centrifuges by Federal Express? The military has to be involved at a high level. There's no question. AQ Khan traveled all of the time. Jim was right about we did watch we watched his travels all the time. He traveled most of the time in the company of Pakistani intelligence officers. And when I was in Islamabad a few weeks ago, you could talk openly to the old time generals, the retired generals, Aslam Beg and Hamid Gul, these guys who were so prominent in the government a decade ago, and everybody knew everything that was going on. So the best guess of many people, and this is something I didn't write because I didn't add, is we think that there's a lot of money that's been shared, too. There's huge profits in this, and AQ Khan obviously hasn't kept it all for himself. He was passing around the goods. So there's a lot of reason to think that it's just sort of impossible to believe the story as it now stands, which is this one man, the father of the bomb. And by the way, as Jim can tell you, too, AQ Khan wouldn't know how to trigger a bomb if he stood in his head. He was a metallurgist who was an expert at getting black market operations on centrifuge, but he certainly wasn't a bomb maker. There were other people in Pakistan. The bomb was made by another man named Khan and another different labs, and the tests were done by them. So it's a big operation. You know, making a bomb involves billions of dollars, extreme secrecy, enormous protection from the government. There never was in the Pakistani budget, the annual budgets made public, there never was a word about nuclear materials, ever. It was always covert. And it looks like a duck walks like a duck. It is a duck.
A lot of hot allegations, nuclear allegations here tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Satish is calling from Boston. Hi, Satish. You're on the air.
Hello. What has happened just now about the Khan network is a little bit similar to something that happened to Seymour Hersh earlier. He said in a book titled The Price of Power that India's Prime Minister Morarji Desai had been a paid CIA agent, etc. What had happened then was I had said in a letter to the Indian press that Prime Minister Indira Gandhi had such a relationship with the CIA, and to neutralize that, the CIA fed to Seymour Hersh this story about Desai being a paid CIA agent.
And Satish, you're saying Seymour Hersh has it wrong? This time, why? How?
Well, I'll come to that. And Seymour Hersh invited me to come see the secret documents that the CIA, he had from the CIA, etc. What has happened now is that the Indian Intelligence Agency, the Research and Analysis Wing, has fed this story to the CIA and the British intelligence agencies. When the CIA and President Bush said that our intelligence agents had been tracking this network of Khans and all that, they are really referring to the Research and Analysis Wing, because I had said in a letter to the press that the Indian Intelligence Agency has continued to function as a branch of British and American intelligence.
So, Satish, you're saying that all of this is a big fiction put out by Indian intelligence to spike the Pakistan-U.S. relationship? Are you serious about that?
Well, the Indian Intelligence Agency has fed this in collaboration with Pakistan, with Libya, with Iran, to the CIA.
Why would they collaborate with Pakistan on charges that would be so damaging to Pakistan's reputation?
India has an interest. There is a campaign in the United States and in the Western countries in general to eliminate the nuclear weapons programs of countries such as Pakistan and India. India has an interest in protecting its own nuclear weapons program, and India has been collaborating with Pakistan for some years now.
Satish, we've got the perspective, and let us pick it up. Thank you for your call. Sai Hirsch, wow, this is maybe a deeper thicket than we imagined. What do you make of all that?
Well, what's to make of it? I mean, I wish it were that simple. The world was that simple. Actually, what I did with Morarji Desai, he never was a CIA agent. He was simply, he had a political party that took, I think, $20,000 a year in payments. But that's a long way from being an agent. He was his own man. But his party did take money from the CIA. And I was sued and won and had about a 3-6 week trial in a federal court on it. And, of course, was able to produce sources to demonstrate that at least I had a basis for saying it,
So there's the Sai Hirsch history, but what about this story? You've got a lot of intelligence sources in here, American, Israeli. I didn't see any Indian sources cited. But
anybody be out of their mind not to talk to the Indians? Like I also talked to the Pakistanis. But in this case, I think what untriggered this, actually, I actually wrote about this quite a bit, that actually Israeli intelligence first picked up evidence of, the story broke because of what Pakistani was helping Iran, and the new allegations emerged about the Iranian bomb. And the Iranians, to everybody's surprise, acknowledged last fall to the International Atomic Energy Agency that indeed they've been basically not telling the truth for 18 years about what they were doing. And I think it's pretty clear Iran's on the way to a bomb. Once a nation decides to get into the bomb business, as Jim said, they go. They want to be.
And you say they're not turning back. But we come into this whole realm skeptical, because if so much could be hidden for so long, then when the news starts to come out, it's hard to know whom to believe. Is this whole story being spun? If so, by whom? I mean, Washington and Islamabad clearly have a spin on it.
No, I think it's comical to think that Indian intelligence is responsible for this story. This Indian intelligence is not responsible for this story.
And Tom, if I can jump in here.
Jim Walsh?
One of the great things about physics and physical evidence is that it's hard to argue with that. You can argue with spin, but if you find crates of unopened centrifuges and you find documents still written in Chinese about bomb designs, and you find blueprints, these things are not, I can tell you, as a student of nuclear history, this is a unique, singular, and startling set of revelations. You don't find it, and you don't, and you'll remember that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, was able in the past to look at documents and determine that they were forged. For example, the documents that allege that Iraq was buying uranium in Niger. But we have an independent nuclear agency here, an international organization like the UN, and we have tons and tons of components, materials, documents and interviews. And it's certainly true that intelligence officials try to spin journalists, and journalists are well aware of that, and they try to discount
that. Sai Hirsch, no stranger to that terrain.
But, you know, you can't ignore the physical evidence, and here the physical evidence is overwhelming.
Pete's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Pete, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Mr. Hirsch, I'm a big fan of yours, and I love your writing. You've done some really great work. My question for you, sir, is I had heard that apparently the tail end of the Clinton administration, they were said some part of the government was investigating this very story that Pakistan and A.Q. Khan in particular were involved in proliferation of nuclear weapons. And when the Bush administration came into office, that investigation was subsequently quenched. My question is there any truth to that?
Pete, you've got a rough phone line, but let us pick that up. Sai Hirsch.
I just don't know. I know that in general, the Bush administration, anything Clinton did, that the joke in the inside the Beltway joke in Washington is the Bush administration was committed to ABC, anything but Clinton. So whatever Clinton was doing, they didn't want to do, which set us back. But no, I think the evidence is that it really transgresses the Democrat Party. This has been a Democrat and Republican. This has been a systematic policy as we heard earlier, of looking the other way for always for other reasons. In the case of Pakistan, they supported us and helped us beat the Russians in the Afghan war. And by the way, there's a wonderful analogy. Just as the Russians were exposed in Afghanistan,
yeah.
I would argue so are we in Iraq.
Exposed,
you know,
to
in the same way.
Exposed in what fashion, Sahersh?
Well, the Russians went in and started a war they couldn't win, and ended up having the United States work against them through through the Pakistani intelligence, run money in with the fundamental opposition. And now I think it's safe to say that in Iraq, certainly you can. Iran certainly has to be taking advantage of what's happening. The Iranian Republican Guards, not Republican Guards, Revolutionary Guard Force, the Quds Brigade. There's a lot of evidence that Iran intelligence is in Iraq, and we've sort of stuck our hiney in the air, just like the Russians did in Afghanistan.
And we're very vulnerable to that kind of manipulation there. I want to get one more call before the break, if we may. Andy's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say I love your show, and hello to your guest.
Thanks, Andy.
My real question is in regards to the relationship between the CIA and the ISI. Your guest had—
That's the Pakistani Intelligence Service, yeah.
Right. Your guest had touched briefly on the fact that obviously the ISI had been instrumental in arming, funding, and to a large extent creating the fundamentalism of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I just felt that it wasn't abundantly clear that that was really, seems to me to be a CIA operation using, excuse me.
So certainly a lot of cooperation between the CIA and ISI in the days of the Soviet invasion. Andy, we've got another hard phone line here, and I'm sorry I'm going to have to let you go with it. But Jim Walsh, we've only got you for another minute. What about that CIA-ISI connection? How did it go so wrong if they were so close during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, I think it went there were common interests here, and the big interest was defeating the Soviet Union, which was seen as the most important threat to U.S. national security. And throughout the Cold War, proliferation was always sort of a second cousin. It never got the priority. The first job was beating the Soviets, and if things slipped out or other countries were helped, then that, you know, that was the cost of doing business. But I think recently it has changed. Obviously, since 9/11, there's been a lot of internal evaluation. But these are both, you know, big bureaucratic organizations, and they don't change very quickly. My guess is the CIA has adapted to the new realities a little faster than ISI. But clearly, ideologically, there are many in Pakistan who do not like the U.S. In the military, among the junior officer corps, and in the intelligence agency, and have closer regional, clan, and other ties to folks that the U.S. Are adversaries with. So I think that continues to be a problem.
Sahersh, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, but you've got very rough quotes on that front. Lieutenant General Hamid Ghul saying, Americans think others are slaves to them. He clearly won't be.
Oh, well, clearly there's a tremendous amount of hostility towards us and towards Musharraf by many of the people who supported the Taliban and supported the jihad and who supported bin Laden. There are many people in Pakistan that did, and certainly our CIA was interwoven with the Pakistani intelligence. There's a new book by the editor of the Washington Post, Steve Call. I think it's called Ghost Warriors, just published. I was just reading the first 150 pages of that book anywhere, exactly what your caller is describing, the close relationship between the CIA and the Pakistani Intelligence Service. They were hand in hand.
For a long time. Jim Walsh at the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you. We'll be right back with Seymour Hersh. We're talking tonight about the unresolved threat of the nuclear weapons bazaar born in Pakistan. Have we mopped up the Pakistan problem or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His article in this week's New Yorker magazine is The Deal, Why is Washington Going Easy on Pakistan's Nuclear Black Marketers? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Henry is calling from Paris, Kentucky. Hi, Henry. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I don't think I've heard anything tonight that I disagree with, except perhaps the overall tenor of the conversation that seems to be leaning toward the fact that the current administration has given away our long-term national security in order to secure a short-term gain in the capture of Osama bin Laden.
Well, we wonder. That's the question that comes to mind. What do you think, Henry?
Well, it seems to me like we've known about this for a very long time. There were other real politic reasons for not rolling on the Pakistanis at the time this was going on, and I'm not sure that any government that is able to put together a nuclear problem or a nuclear program, It is very expensive. It's hard to do. You don't give that stuff away, and I doubt seriously that any of the folks in the apparatus over there were giving away the best stuff. They're giving away things that didn't work. I mean, when we found the remnants of the Iraqi nuclear program after the second Gulf War in the early 90s, we found they were using technology that we had abandoned in the Manhattan Project. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. It's just not very effective.
Henry, those are both great advantages. I've only got Cy Hirsch for a couple more minutes. Let us pick them up. First of all, Cy Hirsch, Henry looks at the deal and says, hey, this may be a very reasonable deal. Washington wants to get Osama bin Laden. They've known what was going on here. This is the leverage they're using to get the green light to go get him.
Well, actually what he said was that that the cost isn't maybe as bad as you think because The people who are making the deal-making, the people who are giving away the goods don't give away their best stuff.
Well, second piece of it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that point is interesting because I think one of the things that generally is true is that, we know that the Iranians' purchase of centrifuges initially that they got from Pakistan were old, dated stuff. Not necessarily up to date, the Mirage steel parts and mostly a lightweight part that would blow away. Centrifuges have to be turned at high revolutions, and the stuff they got initially wasn't very good. But what what happened now is the Malaysian stuff, the stuff we found in Libya, was first rate. It was the most up to date stuff. It was quite exquisite stuff that was put together.
First class centrifuge.
Yes, and it was the kind of material that could be put together, along with the bomb plan, which is just sort of stunning. By the way, the IAEA turned over the bomb plan to the United States. We now have it, because that's not their job. Their job is simply to find enriched materials, not to get into the weapons making.
Seymour Hersh, what about his other question? We've just got a minute here, but the notion that if there's a deal here, maybe this deal is worthwhile.
Well,
Bin Laden for the blind eye, for now, anyway.
If you could convince most of the people I talked with in the intelligence committee, there's two problems with that. One is they're not sure that we're going to get them. This is an operation that's supposed to be very secret, and what they call OPSEC, operational security, isn't very good. We have heard that he's yapping and talking. We've been given information about him yapping and talking. We've heard that before. He's a very smart customer. He knows how we can intercept stuff and respond to it. So he could know more. He could be playing a game. And secondly, does anybody really think getting bin Laden's going to end terrorism? He's just a figurehead. And right now, just like Saddam, the capture of Saddam, although it helped Bush out temporarily politically, he got 10 points right away, has it that ended the insurgency? We're right now looking at civil war in Iraq. It didn't seem to help it. So the personalization of this, which probably wasn't such a good idea in the first place, by making him out to be such a powerful, fantastic person as we did, by targeting him as much, it just could be that there's no evidence that nobody I know in the community believes getting bin Laden is going to suddenly improve. It's certainly going to put a damper on al-Qaeda, but there's many, many other terrorist groups out there, many, many others.
So
there's a lot of people that aren't organized that are willing to die to kill Americans.
So it's not a trade-off that you'd make to see that potential continuing flow of black market nuclear material.
Hey, but I'm not running for president with a war I can't win.
I guess you're not. But you're riding up a storm, and we're always grateful to read it and to hear about it. Seymour Hersh, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Bye-bye, guys.
Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His article in this week's New Yorker magazine is The Deal. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, John Edwards bows out. This is On Point. Today in Raleigh, North Carolina, John Edwards formally bowed out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. The announcement came a day after he failed to win a single Super Tuesday contest. The North Carolina senator notched one primary win in South Carolina last month and had a string of second-place finishes. Here is John Edwards speaking today in Raleigh.
Today, I've decided to suspend my campaign for the presidency of the United States, but I want to say a word about a man who is a friend of mine, somebody who I believe has great strength and great courage, my friend Senator John Kerry, somebody who has fought for and will continue to fight for the things that all of us believe in: more jobs, better health care, cleaner air, cleaner water, a safer world. The truth is, all these, they are the causes of our party, the Democratic Party. They are the causes of America, and they are the reasons we will prevail come November and take back this country. You know, it wasn't very long ago, you'll remember it, it wasn't very long ago that all the pundits and pollsters said, by the time we get to Super Tuesday, there won't be a John even competing, much less fighting for the nomination. Well, we proved those pundits and pollsters wrong, and we're going to prove them all wrong come November when we take back this country. And I want to say a personal word about my friend John Kerry, who I know very well. This is a man that from the time he served this country courageously in Vietnam, all the way through this campaign, I saw it. I know it. I saw what we went through in November and December and back in the summer when everyone said he didn't have a chance. But he showed the strength, the resilience, the courage that he has shown his entire life when he fought for us and for our country in Vietnam. He's done it throughout this campaign. The truth of the matter is that John Kerry has what it takes right here to be president of the United States, and I, for one, intend to do everything in my power to make him the next president of the United States. And I ask you to join me in this cause for our country, for our America.
Senator John Edwards ending his bid for the presidency today in his home state of North Carolina. For perspective on Edwards' impact and political future, we turn to John Wagner, Washington correspondent for the Raleigh News and Observer, who has been covering the Edwards campaign. He joins me now from Raleigh. Good evening and welcome, John Wagner.
Thanks for having me.
And with us tonight from Washington, we're joined by John Harwood, political editor at the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, John Harwood.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you, John. Both Johns. John Wagner, first to you. How do you see John Edwards' reputation down in your neck of the woods surviving what's just happened in the last 6 months?
Oh, I think his reputation in North Carolina has certainly been enhanced by this run. There was a great deal of skepticism when he started about what this first-term senator was trying to accomplish, and I think he proved a lot of skeptics wrong in that he got much further than people had expected.
There's a lot of talk about him as a vice presidential candidate now. Of course, he has he's not going back to the Senate. If he's not the VP, what else would John Edwards do?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of variables here he can't control. If Kerry is elected, there's always a possibility of a cabinet post. Some people have mentioned him as a possible attorney general. If Kerry is not elected, I wouldn't be surprised to see Edwards, out on the campaign trail for 2008 pretty early.
Edwards for president 2008. John Harwood, what's your sense of the lasting impact, imprint of John Edwards on this campaign season and the shape of the campaign that will roll on toward November?
I don't think, Tom, that John Edwards had a dramatic impact on the shape of the Democratic race itself, but he certainly had a big impact on how people view him and his future. This is a guy who has an exceptional ability to connect with voters, and at key moments in the process, he has really stepped up big and shown some talent that I think Democratic politicos aren't going to forget. Two moments that stand out for me. One was after he won the South Carolina primary. He gave a victory speech unlike any I'd ever heard. He took the microphone and he said, you know, tonight there's a 10-year-old girl somewhere who isn't celebrating like we are because she's got, various problems in her life. And he said, I'm speaking to her. She's part of my family. That was an electric moment, and that's a talent not many politicians can demonstrate. today, when he got out of the race in Raleigh, he came and he gave a speech, and you just played the clip a moment ago. He said, John Kerry has what it takes right here, and he touched his heart. That is as good as it gets for a front runner to have a vanquished rival praise him in that way. Perhaps he was auditioning a bit to be vice president, but even if he wasn't, he showed that he has a gift that the Democratic Party is not going to want to throw away.
John Harwood, he was Sonny John throughout almost all of this primary campaign until just the last few days when the strain and lack of wins began to show. Did that brighten up the entire field, and did it work for John Edwards?
It certainly didn't work for Edwards, and he, given the style that he'd campaigned in earlier, it didn't look particularly good on him. The attacks that he made on Kerry in the debate in New York were a bit hollow, but, you know, they were also inconsequential. Everybody knew that he was rapidly approaching the end of the road. And really, on the scale of how these things go, when a politician really goes after one another, that was pretty tame stuff. So I don't think that is going to color perceptions of him or his campaign.
I guess what I'm really asking about is more his consistent persona of being so upbeat and so sunny. It was clearly very appealing to many voters, but he didn't bring home the victories. What do you take away from that?
Well, really, the way this calendar was set up, once somebody broke out into the lead, as John Kerry did in Iowa and then 8 days later in New Hampshire, there wasn't going to be any stopping them. The national momentum wave was uniform across the country. It basically put Kerry in the lead everywhere. It stems in part from the fact that none of the surviving Democrats really had much of a national constituency they could hold on to, and also the fact that the party was very eager to pull together to take on George Bush. So John Kerry, had he gotten another 10,000 votes in Iowa and won the Iowa caucuses, he would very likely be the nominee today.
That is John Edwards, that is.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, yes, John Edwards. He'd be in the position that John Kerry is in today. So he came close, but once he failed to win in Iowa, the die was really cast.
John Wagner, look at the vice presidential calculus with us then. Did you hear John Edwards pumping there for a place on the ticket in the speech that he just gave? And does it look like a good place for him, for John Kerry to have him, to you?
Well, it certainly sounded that way. And what's interesting is, you know, Edwards has steadfastly said he's not interested in the job, wouldn't take it. Of course, it's nothing you can ever campaign for. But, yeah, his aide suggested something he would certainly entertain, and frankly, it'd be hard to see him turning that down.
And, John Harwood, how does it look as a choice for John Kerry? This guy has made a big splash. He appears to be quite popular. Can he deliver what Kerry needs in a vice presidential candidate, electorally, on the stump, the works?
Well, Kerry's got to decide what it is strategically he's trying to accomplish with a vice presidential choice. Some people choose vice presidents targeting a particular pot of electoral votes, and if John Kerry chooses Bob Graham of Florida, you'll know that the sole reason he did it was because Bob Graham might help him carry Florida. John Edwards is very unlikely to be able to help John Kerry carry the state of North Carolina. So if he picks Edwards, and I think that is not a slam dunk by any means, but a real possibility, it would be because
I think
younger and shows an optimistic campaign style that could help across the board and perhaps in some border southern states like Louisiana and Arkansas.
Fascinating. Right now, you can almost hear the Democratic Party rooting for that choice. There may be some disappointment if he doesn't pick John Edwards, John Harwood.
Yes, there would be, but, you know, this is going to be all business when John Kerry gets down to choosing this running mate. They're going to do a lot of polling and research, and everybody knows it, and they're going to try to figure out in very practical terms what they can do to get George Bush out of the White House. There's a good chance that John Edwards would be the guy to help him do that, but everybody knows that that's not necessarily the case.
Very quickly, how soon do you think Kerry will choose a running mate?
Well, Kerry, you know, some people think that the way to go is to accelerate the choice, not wait till the midsummer convention. And certainly Kerry left himself that option open today by naming Jim Johnson, who is a veteran of Democratic politics, to head his vice presidential search.
So we could hear soon. John Harwood, we've got to go. Political editor at the Wall Street Journal, thanks for joining us. And John Wagner at the Raleigh News and Observer. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.